You've been listening to Pacifica Network coverage of the Republican National Convention, brought to you live from Cleveland, Ohio, over WBAI in New York. Listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica radio broadcasting at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. Please support WBAI in New York so we can bring you alternative coverage to important events. Phone 516-620-3602 or go to give2wbai.org, give2wbai.org, and become a WBAI member. It's only $25 for a full year membership, or become a WBAI buddy for $10 or more each month. Again, that's 516-620-3602 or go to the number 2WBAI.org, give2WBAI.org on the web, and become a member of this alternative radio community. It's only $25 for a full year or $10 or more each month to become a WBAI buddy. We really do need your support.
There is nothing wrong with your radio. Do not attempt to switch the station. You are locked into our frequency at 99.5 on your FM dial. If we wish to make it louder, we can turn up the volume. If we wish to make it softer, we can tune it to a whisper. We can take the music and change it to fit all that we want you to hear throughout the course of this broadcast. We can take the music and change it from vintage psychedelia to soft, mystical reggae. We can transform a 60s classic and propel the song right into modern times. For the remainder of the program, sit quietly and we will control all that you hear. You will experience the awe and mystery that takes you from the depth of night and covers your entire body with morning dew. WBAI, New York.
Betu waste oyate dokahe wichake imachi apelo naha yuha chante waste na pechi o te apelo leon ki piki he waste lo oyate hona umpi holo skati wichoni. Greetings and welcome my relatives. I shake your hands with good feelings in my heart and the whole world. Is a beautiful day. It's good for all of us to be here and let the people hear your voice respectfully. Celebrate life in addition to reality. From the Pacifica Radio Network, this is First Voices Indigenous Radio, and I send you greetings and strength from the East Gate of Turtle Island, where the sun and the water touch the earth at once. And our website is firstvoicesindigenousradio.org. Yeah, and I want to thank you for your generosity as always and for being there. You know who you are. And without you, we cannot continue. My name is Teokasin Ghost Horse. I'm your host. Today we have a very special guest, and I've actually did this personally myself about a year ago. I ordered something that we'll be offering here on WBAI and our premiums here in First Voices Indigenous Radio. And remember, that number to call is 212-209-2950. Our first guest, again, Aaron Carapala, is representing the people of this country when it comes to map making. And when you think about Aaron, who grew up in Orange County, California, who is always intrigued by his Oklahoma Cherokee roots, and as we know, that story of the Cherokee moving, being forced to march from the eastern seaboard of North Carolina out to Oklahoma, and about his native history he was interested in, as well as attending all the powwows and teenage years of, you know, getting involved in a Native American community, and working in areas such as the federal recognition for the Calabrino peoples of Orange Counties and other Native peoples in that area of Los Angeles, and fighting racist mascots and bringing Native-friendly curriculum to local schools, and also joining the American Indian Movement, going to land occupations and protests and city hall meetings and more. And he also began to work on handmade map reflecting as many tribes as he could find, and using traditional names in place of the more commonly known ones. And I have lived in many places, excuse me, I'm just reading verbatim here now, but he's lived across the United States. And
well, please forgive us as we switch programs here at WBAI, because with our financial situation the way it is, the fact that we can no longer afford to pay for the 2950 phone number, we have reverted to the 516 phone number. It seems to me I better find a program that contains that phone number. Otherwise, you'll be calling, waking someone up, very likely, while we try to figure this out. A bit of music.
Such a threat. We choose the right to be who we are. We know the difference between the reality of freedom and the illusion of freedom. There's a way to live with Earth and a way not to live with Earth. We choose the way of Earth. It's about power.
Uchasha. Akan tu chasha. Oe to na kechama kakil akan ompi. O ahutopa na hupahu yukhambi. Tako skanskona ompi kele na yuha. Ma kakil akan tanka tako wa echake ake he on. O na ha ohoki chila mani pikte. Ma kakil ohoki la moshikila. He on heche. Le on yuta.
Tatani ma.
Ambetu Washtelo Chante Washte na Pechi Uzapielo Le Unkipiki He Washtelo Oyate Hona Umpi Ohola Oshkate Wichoni. Greetings and good day and welcome, my relatives. I shake your hands with good feelings in my heart, and the whole world is a beautiful day. It's good for all of us to be here. Let the people hear your voice respectfully and celebrate life in addition to reality. From the Pacifica Radio Network, this is First Voices Radio. And I send you greetings and strength from the east gate of Turtle Island, where the sun and the water touch the earth at once. And our website is firstvoicesindigenousradio.org. And I want to thank you for your generosity as always and for being here. You know who you are, and without you, we cannot continue. And I'm your host, Teokas and Ghost Horse. And I'd like to welcome you to First Voices Radio here at WBAI Studios in New York City, here at 388 Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn, New York, one of the five boroughs of boroughs is actually not a donkey. It's other, they say it the other way around, but some of you might take it at, as a humorous note there. But it is one of the five sections or areas of New York City itself. So I'd like to welcome our next guest, Thomas King, who is an award-winning novelist, short story writer, script writer, and photographer, and has many books, including Medicine River, Green Grass, Running Water, Truth and Bright, two short story collections, One Good Story, That One, and Short Story, Short History of Indians in Canada. Anyway, nonfiction, The Truth About Stories, children's books, A Coyote Columbus Story, Coyote Sings to the Moon, Coyote's New Suit, and Coyote's Solstice Tale. And Thomas has edited the literary anthology All My Relations and wrote and starred in the popular Canadian Broadcasting Corporation radio series, The Dead Dog Cafe. Thomas is the recipient of a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Western Library Association in 2004 and an Aboriginal Achievement Award in 2003. He was made a member of the Order of Canada in 2004. And Thomas has taught literature, history, and creative writing at the University of Lethbridge in Alberta, Canada, the University of Minnesota, and the University of Guelph, Ontario, Canada. And Thomas is now retired and lives in Guelph, Ontario. And from Guelph, we are speaking with Thomas King. Thank you for joining us from Ontario.
Pleasure. It's Guelph, by the way.
Oh, Guelph. Okay, I'm looking. Oh, it is Guelph. That's right. Like Elf with a GW, right?
That's right, yeah.
Okay, yeah. I mean, you know, it's a foreign language to me, so I give it a second chance once in a while. So, hey.
Oh, yeah, it's not even English.
It's not? Okay, well, it's a third language, then. That's cool. Hey, you know, Thomas, you know, your book, The Inconvenient Indian, is pretty much part of your life story, and I'd like to talk about the life that brought you up to bringing and writing, and as we know that you've taught literature, history, and creative writing at various universities in Turtle Island or the Western Hemisphere or North America. But, you know, when I looked at this short story of Columbus thing, you know, a short history of Indians in Canada, I'm thinking about, well, it must have been a short story for others who just came here at 1492, but the bigger story is what happened before that. You know, I think that's what we're missing. But your life kind of goes forward and kind of looks into, you know, as you were born in the United States, you know, ended up in Canada, and you saw the differences between nations and how each nation treats its indigenous peoples. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of coming out. It is coming out within your book and The Inconvenient Indian, the ironic comedy or dramatic trauma or whatever it is that is being said in this book. It says a lot. I enjoyed it very much. But I want to talk about you, Thomas. So.
Okay. Boring.
Yeah. Well, let's start out with that boring aspect and we'll get to the meaty part of it. But, and then, you know, there's an excerpt that I'd like to read later about the inconvenient Indian, and it's about dead Indians. Mm. So we'll talk about that. But, tell me a little bit about yourself that you would like to convey to the listeners here in New York.
Well, there's nothing much, not particularly special. I was born and raised out in Central Valley, California, and I started moving around, I guess, when I was young. I'd jump on boxcars and ride them wherever they were going. I'd hitchhike around the countryside. I drove my mother crazy. And I think once you get moving like that at a young age, you sort of stay in motion, and that certainly was me. I've been all over the place. And actually, the longest I've stayed in any one spot is here in Guelph. And that's because my partner likes to sort of hold me in place. I keep looking to move. She says, no, we're staying here. So I say, okay.
Wow. And then how was the difference? You said you were born in California, and later on in life, like now, you live in Canada. Big difference, I think, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, it is, but I mean, it's North America, and that line that divides Canada from the U.S. is really an imaginary line. I mean, Native people have never paid a lot of attention to it, and certainly for the nations that live on that border and are, you know, affected in some ways by the border, you know, the Mohawk, the Blackfoot, any number of tribes. You know, I think we try to ignore it as best we can, mm-hmm. because it's a bother. You know, it separates mm-hmm. families, it separates nations. It's got no more. I mean, it is an imaginary line. That line could change at any point in time. If you look at Europe and look at the way in which the lines that define nations over there have changed throughout history. You can see that line doesn't hold a lot of. So I just move around North America, and you know, I got to show my passport at the border, but yeah. Other than that, I try not to pay a lot of attention to it.
Were you during a time where a lot of Native people would, of course, without the passport? Pre-2001 here, were you during that time when Native people in North America were able to go overseas with just an eagle feather? Do you remember that?
I don't, as a matter of fact. I mean, I know that the Mohawk issued passports, and I think a couple of other tribes issued passports, but I also know that most of the time, those were turned down.
Mm-hmm.
There was a big hullabaloo with, was it Hillary Clinton? There was a lacrosse team that was supposed to go overseas, and they were going to travel on their nation's passports. And the U.S. wasn't going to let them out, and the country they were going to wasn't going to let them in. I think Clinton made some kind of special deal, a one-time deal to, you know, let them travel on that. But I'm fuzzy on that. I've gotten to an age where my memory, which used to be pretty good, is no longer as good as it was, I'm afraid.
Well, fuzzy is a good place to be also when you think about that. And you kind of alluded to that the Native people are giving, I don't know, equality to each other as in the United States as well as Canada. We are one of the same, but it's the indifference or the that the border makes between cultures, I'd say, the American culture and the northern culture of Canada. What happens to me is that the cultural meaning has no effect for Native people. And when we run into the legal jurisdictions, that's when we start getting in trouble. Because I don't think, I do know that last week, or was it, that Canada finally signed the Declaration of Rights for Indigenous Peoples. And that's how slow it is. But yet, being in the United States here, I see Canada is so far ahead of the United States in its treatment of Indigenous peoples. And I'm sure you've seen the turnover in I think you're 70 or 71, but the turnover that goes on from the times you lived in Canada to the United States. What difference is there anyway?
Yeah, actually, I'm 73, but thanks for putting me back a few years.
Cool.
Yeah, the conversation on Native rights and Native issues is stronger and more ongoing in Canada than it's ever been in the U.S. I mean, I've lived half my life in the U.S., half my life in Canada now. And certainly that's a major feature of the two countries. In the U.S., you can hardly get a conversation going about Native issues unless some kind of a disaster has happened. Here in Canada, we just finished up with a number of years ago with the Royal Commission on Aboriginal People. We just had the Reconciliation Commission finish up its work and issue its recommendations. The conversation about what's happening on reserves and in urban areas is an ongoing conversation that you don't see, or at least I don't see much of, happening in the States. Now, what that means in the end, what kind of changes for the good that means for Native people in Canada, I really don't know yet, because until this new administration came in to Ottawa, the old administration was absolutely opposed to any kind of land claim settlements. So it was a dark period for Native people. Now we'll see if that clears up and Canada gets back on track again. I have to wait to see.
It would seem, in my opinion, that, you know, with the new Prime Minister Trudeau in Canada and with the new elections coming up here in the United States, that we're always going forward to expect something better for Indigenous peoples, Native peoples. And we fall into that you know, precept of, okay, we're going to go and we're all going to vote and we wait for the change. And if Trudeau is foretelling what will happen in the United States. Well, Trudeau, he was out visiting all the Native peoples. He was having fun. He was putting headdresses on and smoking pipes. And then all of a sudden things start changing. And I think it's because the system is very oppressing on a person's psyche as much as it is on the Americans who have the national psyche about ever dealing with any contemporary conflicts with tribal peoples, in a sense, that issues are far more politically fraught. In other words, it's slowly and unevenly the mistreatment of Native people. It remains more alive than ever, it seems.
Well, certainly with the two candidates that you guys are fielding at this point, I wouldn't expect there's going to be a lot of conversation about Native issues. I don't think Trump or Clinton are going to pay a lot of attention to that.
And it is interesting, too, also that you said two candidates that the media in the United States is forwarding or is putting in the presence of mainstream media. But here at this station, WBAI, it's another candidate, Bernie Sanders from Vermont.
Yeah, I'd love to see him get on the ticket. I wish him all the luck in the world. I like, you know, what he talks about. I don't know if he's going to have the votes to get there. I mean, maybe. I'll watch that carefully, and that'd be great. That'd be great.
Be great, yeah. And you guys just had the movement, which we felt the effects of, and it kind of was one of the waves of Idle No More back in 2013. And your book, The Inconvenient, came out at the same time. And it basically, the comparison, when someone wrote here about the comparisons of how it would sell here, I mean, the attention it got here was, if it sold 25,000 books in the United States, in Canada it sold 250,000 books.
Yeah. That's
the big difference in how we pay attention to Native peoples across that border.
Yeah, that was, I got ahead of myself on the book. When I finished the book and we published it here in Canada, and it started doing really well. And as you say, the book came out at the same time that Idle No More really kicked into high gear. The two things had nothing to do with each other. I didn't know Idle No More was going to come along, and Idle No More didn't know that the book was going to come out, but it was serendipitous. But, and so I thought, wow, you know, this is going to do really well in the States. I'll be able to go to the south of France maybe on the proceeds. And we couldn't sell it in the States. To a commercial publisher. They didn't like the sarcasm and the snarkiness. But in particular, they had no interest in the Canadian portions. Huh. You know, if it had been all U.S., it might have been a blockbuster. But the other thing, too, is that there isn't much interest in, things native in the States. And so the book really, didn't from what it did in Canada, where it was it was a bestseller, goes down to the States and it just sort of dies. I mean, we were able to get the University of Minnesota Press to publish it, and it has done a little bit here and there, mostly at universities where it's been a kind of first book for incoming freshmen. I think the Northwestern University made it their freshman book of the year. I forget what it was called, One Book Program, I think. And a couple of other places have done the same thing. Mm. But aside from that, it really hasn't had much of a public presence. But again, that happened with a number of books. When Dee Brown wrote Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, it bombed. And it wasn't until years later, and the same thing with Black Elk Speaks. These were books that sort of just sat around for 10, 15 years, and then all of a sudden, for whatever reason, they took off. So who knows? Mm. I'm not too worried about it. I mean, my job is to write the book. It's somebody else's job to try to sell it. I don't worry about that.
Is that terminology, in your view, the politically correct, always getting in the way? It seems that's what people often refer to, or it's their only answer to anything Indian in the United States, that politically correct or incorrect, and we'll go in there and they'll make just kind of tongue-in-cheek remarks like, oh, that was yesterday, it's the past, get up, live today, and think positively and all that stuff. But that seems that statement's deeper than they're saying.
Well, that was one of the issues I took up in the book as I was writing The Inconvenient Indian. I said to myself, why shouldn't we just let the past in the past, be the past and worry about the future? And so in one chapter I said, okay, look, we're going to draw a line. 1985, everything that happens before 1985, we're going to forget about. As Native people, we're just going to forget about it and get on with our lives, and this is supposed to provide us with a new strategy forward. And what I found out was that everything that happened before 1985 was being repeated after 1985. So nothing much had changed in terms of policy philosophy in North America. And it was an eye-opener for me, because I thought we had made all this progress, or I assumed we had. And as I did my research on the book, I discovered that most of the attitudes that had been alive in the 17th and the 18th and the 19th century, the 20th century, had followed us into the 21st century. And so while we were making all sorts of, you know, noises about equality and whatnot, the fact of the matter was that Native people were still being treated in large part with the same kind of disdain that we had been treated with in 1886. That was an eye-opener for me.
Mm-hmm. You often were starring role in the Dead Dog Cafe Comedy Hour, which we don't get here except if we, you know, go across the cable wires into Canada and look for the Dead Dog Cafe and, you know, any kind of reruns. But yeah. It was basically a comedy show that ran on public radio from, I guess, 3-year run, maybe 4-year runs. And
about 5-year run, mm-hmm. something like that, off and on. CBC never quite knew what to do with it, I don't think. It was a 15-minute show. We pretended it was an hour long.
Okay.
And you know, at the 7.5-minute mark, we would say, okay, in our second half hour.
Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, and Canadians have at really the memories of that, and there was one someplace I read about a joke. Someone asked, why is it good to have Indians in Canada?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. There was, it was 10 reasons why it's good to have Indians in Canada. And the first reason was because it gave the RCMP live targets to practice on.
That's funny, but yet it is not, because that's what's really happening with the missing peoples. And I think that's a current ongoing situation now here in the United States, especially around the more traditional Native places and reservations out in the northern parts of the West, I guess, say Montana and Dakotas and Wyoming and that area. There's a lot of people starting to miss. They're missing. And their state of emergencies now, and several reservations about missing people, and it's running into the hundreds now, and they just can't find them for some reason. So that statement is you need live targets to practice on. But I'd like to hear the other ones if there are any more.
Well, I think one was cheap cigarettes. I forget what some of the other ones were. I had all 10 of them. We were going to put them on a T-shirt at some point.
Oh, I'd like that. Yeah, yeah.
But we didn't do it. It was a small show. It had a good run. It was fun to do. We did some live performances from time to time, but it really was. I mean, the beauty of that show was that I got paid for complaining about things that pissed me off.
Yeah,
so you can't get a better job than that.
There's a quote from something. It's, ask a typical American who doesn't have Indian heritage or live near a reservation about Indians, and he or she will likely conjure up two images: the war-whooping enemies from old Hollywood westerns and casinos. Most Americans, especially those of more liberal caste, will acknowledge the genocide of untold millions of indigenous peoples, but in the American mind, that period is past, ugly and unfortunate, perhaps, but belonging to another era, one remembered primarily in sepia tones. And that's what it is. We often, you know, go back to that time when everything, all those Native that Charles Curtis brought out in those sepia tone giant posters and, you know, photographs. And that's where we're at. And a lot of, do you find a lot of younger people often going back to that time and using that as if that's how we're supposed to be? Because, you know, we can get all the education we want, but when we're feeling it inside, we often go back to those elders, as I would say, and on those pictures and media, social media such as Facebook, has a lot of memes about those times and reminders. It gets very sentimental. Is that holding true in Canada as well?
Oh, yeah. I think in North America, you can't escape the image of that 19th century native. It's sort of etched into the minds of North Americans and native people, too. I mean, we're not immune from that iconography. It's helped by the older literatures. Certainly, it's helped by any of the westerns that people come up with. I mean, there have been attempts to try to complicate that. My favorite probably is in the movie what was the thing called Maverick, where a buddy of mine, Graham Greene, plays kind of a con man Indian. And, you know, that role sort of, you know, turned the image of the noble savage around a little bit. But those films are far and few between. And normally when, even in this day and age, if you do a Western, you sort of have the typical Western Indian there. And we see that figure over and over and over and over again. And I'm not saying that it never existed. I'm just simply saying that it's only one image of native people, but it's the one the North Americans like. We don't have the Greeks and the Romans. We don't have a kind of European antiquity that we can point back to, and so our antiquity is native people.
Yeah, antiquity, even referring us and putting into the history, and this is on the street experience. Thomas is a. But when someone says, well, what sign are you? You probably get this too. What sign are you? And you're kind of thinking, oh, I think I'm a Libra.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, then they tell you all about your sign and stuff. But then do you say, then, I mean, in my day, I would say, but the native people, we have our own signs of the constellations and the stars and stuff. And wouldn't you like to know ours and
yeah.
how they affect us? And but that kind of, they get glassy-eyed and go away, you know, because that history doesn't matter, but it's just as valid. And yeah. that's where we're at right now in this day and age.
So what's your sign?
Yes, what's your sign? It's kind of like a pickup line also, I think. What's your sign?
I'll leave that for the younger guys.
Yeah. So, you know, when it comes to that idea of, you know, the glossy-eyed, American looking to find some solace in avoiding. And this is what I'm saying. They find solace in avoiding the truer history of the Western hemispheres, even down into, South America, Central America. But this is North America. The inconvenient Indian, to me, had that right. I don't know what it is that pushed the button in me and said, what is an inconvenient Indian?
Yeah.
And yet we don't, ourselves as Native, don't want to acknowledge that. We don't want to be inconvenient.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, we're inconvenient because we're still here.
Yes.
You know, we were supposed to die off quite a while ago. I don't know how many obituaries for Native people I've read over the years and newspapers and books of the time of the 19th century, 7th, 18th, 19th century. We were supposed to die. It's a nasty surprise that we're still here and in numbers and still trying to maintain our cultures and our languages. So that part's inconvenient because North America really doesn't want to think about Native people. Certainly in the U.S. that's true, not as true in Canada, but a conversation on Native anything in the U.S. is, unless something happens, it's not cocktail talk, it's not political talk. I haven't heard Obama mention anything about Native people. I don't expect that whoever gets in as the next president is going to have that as a major part of their agenda. And you could argue that there are other things more pressing in the world than Native people, but if you're a Native person and you have a concern about that, you know, that doesn't cut it as an excuse, especially given the kinds of conditions on many reserves throughout North America. I mean, it really is a scandal, you know, no good drinking water, health facilities, educational facilities. You can go on and on. I mean, right now we're dealing with a situation at Attawapiskat that is pretty grim. You know, just a flurry of suicides, and the suicides are the symptom of a situation on that reserve that needs to be looked at. And, you know, that situation is prevalent on other reserves, too. I mean, it bothers me a great deal that Native people get ignored in North America. It's almost as if North Americans are saying, well, you know, they should have died off a while ago, and maybe if we don't see them or don't pay attention to them, they might disappear. And, of course, we're not going to. We're pretty tough.
Pretty tough cookies, yeah. You know, that saying, you know, late in the book, The Inconvenient Indian, which you are the author of, is that you pose that question about non-Native readers' minds, and you said, you asked the question, what do Indians want?
Yep.
And, you know, and you quote, but you turn the question on its head, saying that better question is what? What do whites want?
Yep. Yep.
And you answered, whites want land.
Yep. Yep. But when you boil it down, I mean, nothing is quite that simple. And although, you know, when you're writing this stuff, it's always nice to have a little simple answer for a complicated question. But when you boil it all down to the answer is land. Native people control land in North America. We're the only group that does. Mm-hmm. The only cultural, ethnic group that controls the kind of land. And it's a pain in the ass because when they try to, when, for instance, in Canada right now, there are pipelines that companies want to run through Native reserves. And they have to deal with Native people on those reserves. And by and large, those reserves are not wanting those pipelines to come through their territory. And so that's a pain in the butt. You know, if the tribes weren't there, then the companies wouldn't have to deal with this. Same thing with energy extraction, be uranium, oil, coal, whatever. Many of those resources are on reservations and reserves throughout North America. And it means that the people have a say in whether or not that material is taken out of the ground. And in some cases, the tribes have said, no, we don't. We don't need you to come in here and dig up the land, and that has created problems for these large companies. I mean, the Navajo Reserve is a good example. The Crow Reserve is a good example, and the mindset by private companies in North America is that, you know, Native people shouldn't get in the way of their profits and their exploration, that land is really not Native land, when in actual fact it is. And so that's been a thorn in the side of companies. That's been a thorn in the side of government. So, you know, and if there was a way in which either Canada or the U.S. could abrogate all treaties and take Native land out of federal protection, I think they would. I think if they thought they could get away with it, they would.
Mm-hmm.
Which would mean, I mean, they've done that in the past, certainly with the Termination Act, the Allotment Act. These were all national policy decisions in the U.S. to get rid of the Native estate. Mm-hmm. And they were very effective, as a matter of fact. We lost a tremendous amount of land during those periods.
And it would seem that, you know, the common question asked us as Native people is, get over it. But yet, if you turn that around to them, get over it. You know, that you cannot just individualize everything, because as a whole, this is communal land here in the United States for Native people and in Canada. And I'm always looking to Canada as yeah. in as no border, and I'm looking to know the history of my brothers and sisters of all races, but especially the native peoples who have a lot of land, who have a lot of pristine land, much more so than here in the 48 contiguous states. That what we're fighting down here is much a different monster, so to speak, but yet it's the same monsters as when it comes to the Western mind up there. They have the king and queen. Down here we have the president and multinational corporations, which happens to be the king and queen, and everybody becomes individual pieces. And that's basically where it is. They want the land. And how, you know, what I'm thinking about, so I'm trying to formulate this question. I'm pretty sure you know where I'm going with this, is that the timing of the presidents, and I am often saying, because I've been doing radio here for 25 years now, and I'm thinking that every 4 years the administration turns, and therefore we are affected as Native people, and yet those Native people are saying, well, go out and vote. But yet it's not so effective, because it's not who you put into office, it's the system that's still in place.
Well, I mean, I'm not opposed to voting, and I vote in every election, but I don't know that voting in the elections changes the attitude of various administrations towards Native peoples. I think those are moved by other forces that come along. You can have good administrations, even if they don't do much of anything for Native people, as opposed to really bad administrations who are actively looking to destroy the tribal estate. Certainly here in Canada, we've come through a couple of those lately. So, you know, things could get worse, I guess, is what I'm saying. Yeah. They may not be great now, but they could get worse. I think you need to keep that in mind. I think we need to be politically active.
Yes.
You know, that's part of the world in which we live. You know, certainly we need to be politically active on our own home reserves, and probably out in the larger world too, for that matter.
Mm-hmm. And in the term inconvenient Indian, when the Native person is in the way of a clean history, a clean slate for the Westerners who came here, and we stand in that way. But when it comes to climate change, it seems that's the end all. We all have to arrive at a place where we have to understand that there is something happening right underfoot. And it maybe is this way where we're thinking about how we live with the land. And I like to be encouraged, Thomas, is that Native people still have the seeds as to how and what to do. And because of the experience of, we call it nature in the Western world, but we call it Mother Earth, Grandmother Earth. And we're thinking in terms of, we know how to do this now. How come you're not coming to us? Because we know how to do this, but yet the exploitation of our words, our thoughts are being taken over, and they're learning how to walk, if not even still crawl. But the birth of, like, the idle no more, it birthed that mentality. First, it was a resistance by and a complete surprise to the Canadians at large, and then the United States, the flash mobs. But that was the youth speaking from our cradles as younger people. And when it came to nature, I think that was the undertow of everything. Is that it comes to the land, the views that we have about land is that you protect it. It's your mother. But yet the other way is to own it. We must exploit it. We must take it, because we're going to starve if we don't basically destroy that land.
Well, I mean, the land within the Western mind is seen as a commodity. It can be bought. It can be sold. You can move it around. You can do whatever you want with it. It's only useful if it provides you with something, provides you with energy, provides you with, I don't know what, but it's not something that is sacred in and of itself. Mm-hmm. It is a commodity. And as long as it's viewed as a commodity, nothing much is going to change. I don't think, at least. Mm-hmm. I don't know how we're going to be able to turn that thinking around, but until we do, things are simply going to get worse. The thing I like about the people, I talk to people who don't believe in climate change. I used to do a lot of lecturing. I don't lecture anymore. I got tired of hearing the sound of my own voice, to be honest with you. Mm. And there are other voices that people should be listening to. North America has this habit of finding one or two people to act as spokespeople, and it's a lousy situation to be in. You know, there are multiple voices out there that should be listened to, but that aren't. But anyway, when I talk to people about climate change, I say to them, I said, you know, think of the Earth as a room, not a very large room, and you put one person in there with a candle, and it's okay. You put two people in there with two candles, and that's okay too. You put 20 in there, and it starts to get a little crowded, a little stuffy, and the air isn't quite so good. You put 100 people into that room, and things are going to change dramatically. And I said, you know, whether you believe in climate change or not, the population of the world has exploded to the point where, you know, human existence has got to be pressing hard on the environment. There's, you know, you just can't have it any other way. You can't keep putting more and more people into a finite area, which is the Earth that we live on, and not expect changes to take place. So, you know. But much of the time I look into their eyes and I feel as though I'm just flapping my gums for no reason whatsoever.
Yeah, it does seem like that after a while. And I just came back from another country, and I see the treatment of the ideas, the assumptions have carried over to the United States. And this is not a negative note here. This to me is something that there are more countries aware about Native peoples in this country, in this continent, in the Western Hemisphere, than the other peoples who live in the Western Hemisphere beside Native people. And I really enjoy that, because I didn't have to talk politics when I was over there. I didn't have to talk about, you know, what everybody else is talking about here with the front running candidates and things, because from afar it seems that they're saying the same thing. But they over there know. They're saying, well, what about the Native peoples? How come they're not talking about the Native peoples? And you alluded to that should be the first thing on the agenda, because they are going to be taking care of the land. And I'm probably, you know, barking up a tree here, but that I think that's what's happening. I think that's what we really need to look at, the long association with Native people such as you and I, despite that history, the differences that we now share. But America no longer sees the Indians, and that's what they are seeing abroad, is that we're invisible to the American conscience.
Yeah. Well, the odd thing about Europeans is that, of course, they don't have Indians,
yeah,
per se.
That's right.
They see us from afar. They see us through the eyes of people like Karl May, who wrote about Indians but never saw an Indian and never came to the U.S., but the further away you are from Native people, the more sympathetic mm-hmm. you generally tend to be. So if I go to the East Coast, I get more sympathy there than if I go out to the Dakotas.
Mm-hmm.
I get more sympathy out in California than I do when I go to Montana. It seems the closer that people live to Native people, the harsher the criticisms are. And if you look at where incidents have happened, normally it's in those places where you have a high Native population. So people who live close to Indians don't think as well about Native people as people who are far away. So it's for me, that's a problem. It means that, you know, the Europeans, for instance, aren't dealing with Native issues. They just sort of see us from afar, and we're almost, I hate to say it, but we're almost a curiosity.
Yeah.
I know when I was in France for the first time, I had a photographer who wanted to take my picture, and he was really disappointed when he saw me, because at that point in time I had a mustache. I hadn't ever been able to grow a mustache. My brother grows nice mustaches, but I had never been able to grow one. But when I was about 40 years old, I discovered if I waited about 6 months, I could get a pretty decent-looking mustache. And so when I got to France, I had my nice mustache. And the photographer says, oh, I didn't know Indians had mustaches. You don't look very Indian. I said, yeah, a lot of us got mustaches. And he says, oh, yeah. He says, well, how about maybe I take your picture? I said, well, what do you want me to do? And he says, could you stand on the pool table with this pool cue like a spear? And I said, why would I do that?
Ooh, yeah.
And he says, well, he says, you know, he says, that's what I have in my mind. And I said, I'm not going to do that. I said, I would never stand on a pool table with a pool cue as a spear, you know, for a photograph or whatever else. But, I mean, you know, I could see that he was disappointed in me, and he was disappointed in my unwillingness to pose for him. I wasn't angry with him or anything. It just reminded me, you know, that image of Native people is alive and well, and certainly the further away from reserves you go, the more romantic that image turns out to be.
Yeah, and in your book, Inconvenient Indian, you bring out that irony and make it humorous and laughable. I'm looking through it again, and I'm remembering, oh, yeah, this and that. And that's what this book is really about, to take that. And as you know, when you're among Native peoples on reserves or reservations, that the people are either too serious or either laughing. Most of the people are laughing all the time, to find everything in humor. And that's what I want to express to the peoples out there, that although we've been talking about, you know, serious issues here, that also that we find humor. We have to find humor in that, because, you know, what can be worse than anything? Because everything is about ready to get better anyway. There's a sign that goes around on some social media, says a Native person standing in New York with a sandwich board, message board, saying, the beginning is near.
Well, it's a survival strategy, humor.
Yeah.
I mean, you're quite right. I go on reserves, and sometimes things are not very good, but, you know, there's always time for a joke and a way to look at it kind of at an angle that makes you laugh. And satire in particular, I find, is alive and well. I think it's just, you know, you look at your situation and say things are so terrible, they're funny.
Yeah.
They're so bad, you know, they make you laugh. And if you can do that, if you can turn that, then it helps you. I think it helps you deal with some pretty awful situations.
And I think, you know, my experience is finding that within the humor is our cultural continuity. I think that's why we're still here. No matter through thick and thin, Native people go back to their culture and rely on that strength, whether they know it or not, they feel it somehow. And that's what I look forward to, because I get the often question, what are you doing in New York? What are you doing in New York City? And like, you know, but what's under the concrete?
You know? New York City used to be Native land.
Yeah. Yeah. I get that whole thing, but, you know, the populace are like, no, where do Indians exist? And there's one passing by them every 2 million people or not, you know, and that's how it is. And you know, Thomas, has been a real, real good thing, a pleasure interviewing you here about the book and yourself, actually, and understanding a little bit more what it takes to, you know, just an average everyday person writing a book. And what would you have to say to up and coming folks? And I always like to think I'm up and coming also. to continue, you know, being who we are as the Indian, even before that, the Native, before 1492.
Yeah. Well, I mean, for me, one of the hard things was, because I was a political activist when I was young, and I think probably I spent a good deal of time trying to do everything, you know, trying to be, you know, a frontline activist, trying to be, you know, a community organizer, trying to, you know, do all these things that in large part I wasn't very good at. I'd like to think that I was good at those things, but in actual fact, I probably wasn't. But what I was good at was as an observer, and I could write about those things. But it took me a lot of years to figure out that you can't do everything. And so, you know, if you have, if you can manage it, figure out what you're good at. Figure out what you enjoy doing, and do it. And don't try to be everything to everybody. People would say to me, you know, when I'd write a book, they'd say, well, you know, come on out and get involved with this. And I would, normally I would, I'd say, okay. And then after a while, I discovered that I couldn't do both things. I couldn't do the writing, I couldn't do the commentary, and I couldn't do, you know, the activism. I couldn't do, you know, the work within the community that I might do, but I wasn't very good at. And so I said, you know what? I got to write. That's what I do. That's what I'm good at. That's my contribution. And other people will have to do the other things.
Yeah.
That's a hard decision to make.
Yeah.
Because people come at you sometimes and say you're not doing enough.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I do know, in going out here, that your wife had something to do with this book. You know,
Oh, yeah. Big mouth that she has.
and staying in one place for a while, you know. But Thomas King, who is an award-winning novelist, short story writer, scriptwriter, and photographer, has been being interviewed right now, and I'd like to thank you for being here. And the book that we were talking about, or at least referring to, was An Inconvenient Indian, which could be titled many different titles because we've talked about so many things. And I do know that I will be talking to you in the future sometimes. Because are you working on a new book?
Well, I was working on a new book, and I sort of hit a wall, and so. I'm working on some music now. I'm trying to work up a musical, actually, a native musical.
Oh, there you go. Hey, you need a flute player?
I can always use I can always use a good musician.
Oh,
can you sing?
I can sing. Yeah.
All right.
I'm going to squeal on myself a little bit. I'm actually next Tuesday evening. I'm appearing at the Apollo here in New York City.
Oh.
Yeah. So you know, come on
That's
out.
Big time.
Come on out, and yeah, we'll see what we can do. And
yeah. I'll bring my cornet.
There we go.
We'll do some traditional music.
Traditional jazz, yeah.
Yeah.
That's great. Well, Thomas, thank you so much for being here on First Voices Radio.
Pleasure. Take care.
Cool. That is Thomas King, who is the author of The Inconvenient Indian, A Curious Account of Native People in North America. And we were just having a conversation. And that's what the station's about. And with you out there, the supporters of WBAI and First Voices Radio, would notice that I did drop the word indigenous because there's a whole different, horse and cart, to say the least. And so that's what I'd like to say about indigenous. That's why we call ourselves First Voices Radio now. Working with the UN for many years, and especially a friend for the last 26 years, Stephen Newcomb, who just recently stood before the Pope, and the Pope stood before Steve Newcomb and the whole Western world about rescinding the Doctrine of Discovery in 1493. Steve Newcomb, as always, we met on a mountaintop there in Nevada 26 years ago, and we greeted each other with his Shawnee Lenne Lenape language and my Lakota language. I stepped up and said, Chante washte na pech yu zapielo, I greet you with my heart, a good heart. And he said the same in his, and he parted ways, and he said, Wanishi. And I says, Mitaku yasi. And then I said, Doksha ake. So we're going to do that. We're going to take a break and see you right in a minute or two or 3 minutes. And I need to get a drink of water. Then I'm going to ask you to call the pledge line here to raise funds for the Inconvenient Indian here on First Voices Radio and WBAI. That number to call, just to remember, 516-620-3602. 516-620-3602. We'll be back in a few minutes. Thank you. Thank you.
the sun, I see a child, I see my mind passing me by, I see forever.
All right, this is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, right here at 388 Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn. And this is First Voices Radio. That track was Ebbett and the Indigo Children, cut from the album. I can't get it right now. Okay. Anyway, we'll get that to you, and I'd like to, wonder what happened. Okay, but here we are. Tyokazin Ghost Horse and your host for the last, since 2012, March 28th. That's what it is. March 28th. August is another month. That when all the power went off back then in 2003, I see. Okay. Yes. Okay. Here we go. March 28th, 2002, the first broadcast of First Voices Indigenous Radio at that time. Right now it's First Voices Radio. And the reason why we stopped using indigenous on this program is because of the content of the etymology of the word indigent, meaning poor, genus, meaning race. And so when it's referred to in the UN, and you think about all the indigenous peoples, the majority of those peoples, if not 99% of indigenous peoples across the planet, are poor materially. We are so-called undeveloped or underdeveloped. And when you think about indigent race, poor people over there, so you're thinking about somebody not involved in modern society, somebody off on a reservation, because that's where it's poor. So I dropped indigenous because of that, the original meanings of that, way before the Western got a hold of that Latin word, indigenous. And that's why we are not and no longer will be called First Voices Indigenous Radio. We'll be called First Voices Radio. And that's one reason why we are looking out to you, our supporters out there, for First Voices Radio, that you do look towards Native people. And the last conversation we had with Thomas King, who is of Cherokee descent, of the people in North Carolina's and Eastern Coast, who now lives in Canada. He's an author of The Inconvenient Indian that we are offering to you today. For $100, this book that we talked about and referred to the curious account of Native people in North America, because we are the inconvenient Indian. We are in a way of progress, of manifest destiny, of total ownership of land, of total destruction of the land. We are in the way as Native people. The pledge line to call is 516-620-3602 to get your book. We have 13 of these books here, The Inconvenient Indian. And I'm asking you, my name is Teokas Ngostorst, the host for the last 13, 14 years now here on WBAI New York, First Voices Radio. Pledge line, 516-620-3602, simple. 516-620-3602. 516-620-3602. The Inconvenient, which is a curious account of Native people in North America. And during the interview this last hour, I was going to read an excerpt, which I didn't really get around to, but I will excerpt from The Inconvenient Indian on page 53 and 55. Dead Indians are sometimes just that, dead Indians. But the dead Indians I'm talking about are not the deceased sort, nor are they all that inconvenient. They are the stereotypes and the cliches that North America has conjured up out of its experience and out of its collective imaginings and fears. North America has had a long association with Native people, but despite the history that the two groups have shared, North America no longer sees Indians. What it sees are war bonnets and beaded shirts and fringed deerskin dresses and loincloths, headbands and feathered lances and tomahawks and moccasins and face paint and bone chokers. These bits of cultural debris, authentic and constructed, are what literary theorists like to call signifiers, signs that create a simulacrum, which Jean Brugelar, the French sociologist and modern postmodern theorist succinctly explained as something this is never that which conceals the truth, is never that which conceals the truth. It is the truth which conceals that there is none. And for those of us who are not French theorists, but who know the difference between a motorhome and a single wide trailer, a simulacrum is something that represents something that never existed. Or, in other words, the only truth of the thing is the lie itself. Dead Indians. You can find dead Indians everywhere. Rodeos and powwows and movies and television commercials. After all, dead Indians are the only antiquity that North America has. Europe has Greece and Rome. China has the powerful dynasties. Russia has the Cossacks. South and Central America have the Aztecs, the Incas, and the Maya. North America has dead Indians. This is why didn't show up at a DR ground, at a show full of, showy gowns, and why, and didn't even arrive at their respective events in Brioni suits, Canali dress shirts, ties, and Salvatore Ferragamo shoes, whatever cultural significance they may have for Native peoples. The Hollywood Indians, full featherhead dresses and beaded buckskins are, first and foremost, white North America's signifiers of Indian authenticity. Their visual value at ceremonies in Los Angeles or in Ottawa is, as the credit card people say, priceless. Whites have always been comfortable with dead Indians. General Phil Sheridan, famous for inventing the scorched earth tactics used in Sherman's March to the Sea, is reputed to have said, "The only good Indian is a dead one." Sherman denied saying this, but Theodore Roosevelt filled in for him. And that's my question. Are you filling in for what Sherman said? Is the Indian dead in your mind? Are we gone in your mind, in your conscience, or is your conscience being affected? Is your consciousness not about Native people? Well, why should it be? You have so many bills to pay, money to earn, and new cars to buy, and new clothes, and be the coolest sayings, and forget about history. It doesn't have to do with now. But we bring this to you every Thursday as much as possible here on First Voices Radio, 9 a.m., right after Democracy Now, 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. After that, it's a free-for-all. Right now, it's 9 to 10. This is radio for the Native people who want to listen. And I know I say this because you too, deep in your DNA, someplace, you're native to someplace. I no longer will use the word indigenous to say that. Native to someplace. Have we forgot that connection? Is that your constellation, is to forget who you are, just like America wants to forget about who you are? There are Native people who remember and are working actively to decolonize their mind, to decondition their mind, not recondition it with the latest anything to come, say, like we are a part of America. Yet we know that we have to deal with this relativity, because as it is, the reality is not what it used to be. It's always been the same for Native people, so yet that inconvenient Indian mentality is there. Oh no, they're talking about Native things again. Be positive now. Be positive. The Inconvenient Indian, a curious account of Native people in North America. We are offering this to you, this book by Thomas King, for $100. Please call that number, 516-620-3602. 516-620-3602. This is the number to call to get this writer who is a better positioned to tell a rich Native history that reveals the common threads weaving North American patterns across the boundary line between Canada and the United States. The Inconvenient Indian sweeps popular culture, law and policy, and the complexities of resistance and reinvention, framing all the tough issues through King's powerful storytelling and penetrating eye. And you heard the last hour Thomas King talking about the differences and the similarities between Native peoples, but also how Canadians, Canadian citizens, American citizens tend to view us almost in the same, throw us all in the same basket, so to speak. And the Inconvenient Indian may well be unsettling for many non-natives in this country and in Canada to read. This is exactly how we should all read it, especially now. Thomas King uses the stories to turn history upside down. Or perhaps it is more accurate to say that he presents history with a creator, with a candor and honesty rarely found in usual accounts of the interaction of Aboriginals and non-Aboriginals, Natives and non-Natives. The Inconvenient Indian is couched in plain-spoken forthrightness that shocks as often as it demystifies. It is essential reading for everyone who cares about Canada and the United States, who seeks to understand Native people, their issues, and their dreams. Thomas King is beyond being a great writer and a storyteller, a lauded academic and an educator. He is a towering intellectual. The Inconvenient Indian is less an indictment than a reassurance that we can create equality and harmony, a powerful and important book. This is said by Philip J. DeLoria, the Vancouver Sun, Winnipeg Free Press, The Globe and Mail. And as I started out the interview, if this book sold in the first 2 weeks, 250,000 copies. And in the United States, it basically didn't even go anywhere, because it was too relative. It was too real. It was too relative for the reality that we're experiencing here in the United States about and for and with Native people. And I'm asking you, as the host of First Voices Radio, from the get-go, and I've always asked you to step forward. We have 13 copies of this book here in studio, here, even one of mine. And so we have them already mailed. They are here. And I look forward to having the WBAI staff send these out to you ASAP. As soon as you pledge, I want to ask them to get it right to you. And I know that we have our storied past, but yet right now these are in house right here, right now. And you can hear me tap on this table because I know they're here. $100 for The Inconvenient Indian by Thomas King. The pledge line, 516-620-3602. 516-620-3602. And it's not fluffy language, right? It's not I do this and I do that and I am this and I am that. No, we do this. We do that. And we are going to pledge to keep we, WBAI, on the air. W stands for we. BAI, I'll have to find something. I mean, I know Amy Goodman says we beg at alternative interview intervals, but it means something else than that. We. W is we. And I want to go to that and say, support this we station. It's not an I anymore. It's we. And that's what they don't want to hear. You know who all they are. They don't want to hear we are together. We are a community. We are responsible for this station, WBAI. And yes, we have a radio program that brings native issues. Always has been here for 14 years. And we'll always bring that. 516-620-3602. Pledge line, 516-620-3602. For $100, The Inconvenient Indian. Tell people you want this. Do you want to read it? Because I heard the interview. Also, the book, if you guys are readers out there, you can go through the titles. It says, Forget Columbus. That sounds like, oh, well, let's read that. Let's forget Columbus. Let's forget Columbus, right? And go forward. And then the end of the trail. Okay, it's over. But this burden is too heavy to lift. These are titles. These are contents of the book. Forget Columbus. The end of the trail. Too heavy to lift. One name to rule them all. Indians. We are sorry. Like cowboys and Indians, forget about it. What Indians want. As long as the grass is green and happy ever after. These are titles of this book. And you can get deeper into it and read. And as I was reading through here, Michael G. Haskins was flipping through and seeing, skipping through and writing. And I know he listened to the interview. And, you know, I know that you are a seasoned veteran, as they say, Michael, about all of this and understanding. And I've been, I think, with you 5 years now as a producer. Mm-hmm. And you being on the air as an engineer, and you've heard a lot of things about Native people. And from this viewpoint, which is very non-stream Native viewpoint. And as you know, we started out with Indigenous. Now we are more Native than Indigenous. We're not the poor people anymore, because it's not been the judgment of how much we own. It's about how much we give and the generosity. This is where Native comes in.
I want to start there, Teokasin. I want to thank you so much for educating us about why is the change in name. First Voices Indigenous Radio is a good sounding name. I like that name. That was, it felt good. Now we know why it's changed. Now we know why. You said you are Native to someplace. That's right. You are Native to some place. We're in a spring membership and fundraising drive, and Teokasin has this great special, this great offer for us. The conversation, not an interview, a conversation that he had with Thomas King, that stands on its own, hearing the insights of this award-winning author. But we have that here, and we're so appreciative to Teokasin for reaching out to Thomas King, having him on. And we have this very fine offer, the book, The Inconvenient Indian, A Curious Account of Native People in North America. The number is 516-620-3602. But you know something, Teokasin? It's not about the, I mean, the book is a good book, and I'm sure, as I'm just trying to thumb through it right now, it's a good book. It's a very, very, it's readable, very easy to read. But that's not why we're asking you to make a contribution. Not for the book itself, for the program. For the program and for the station, so that the station can be here, so that Teokasin can bring you on a weekly basis, as much as possible, because he travels and all of us travel and have things to do and interests, to bring this program to you without interruption, without interference. No one said to Theokesson, well, you know what, I don't think that's a good idea to do Thomas King, because, you know, he said some things that we really don't like and we don't subscribe to, or any of the other programs that Theokesson has brought to you. He's never had to run this by anyone, nor any of the rest of us have had to do that. Let me read something. So Theokesson read something from the book. Let me read something. One name to rule them all. Okay? If North America doesn't like live Indians and it doesn't like legal Indians, why doesn't the military, political, corporate complex just kill us off? I know this question sounds melodramatic and absurd, but I've been to rallies, marches, and protests where some clever wit has shouted out from the crowd, we should have killed all you, expletive deleted, Indians when we had the chance, unquote, by the way. I'd like to believe that this kind of remark is just the huffing and puffing of bigoted buffoonery, but I've heard it too many times. Such sentiments may not be the rule, but neither are they the exception. Now, that's just a paragraph of chapter 4, the beginning of chapter 4, One Name to Rule Them All, just giving you just a taste, just a sampling of what will be in this book. Again, the most important thing is having First Voices Radio here so that each week you can hear the guests that Theokesson brings on without commercial interruption. Did you hear what Thomas King was talking about? The conditions on the reserves, reservations, the land, the pipelines, the native people. 516-620-3602. And he was so right. I mean, I almost jumped out of my seat, Theokesson, when Thomas King said, if there was a way that the U.S. could get out of the treaties that were made over the past 100+ years, they would certainly do so. Let's hear from you now, folks. Support this program and support this radio station. 516-620-3602.
And thank you, Michael. 516-620-3602. It is true that, you know, when my history as an individual, you know, dealing with the boarding schools coming up and then being taken away from culture, many people would say, well, you really aren't an Indian because that you don't fit the sepia tones, as I said, the sepia tones of what America still thinks about us, or the militant type. And that once you lost your language, once you've gone away, that you no longer are native, but we don't know. You don't know that, because that's just sort of a projection for what America is basically based on. They can say, well, we're this from this culture, we're from these peoples, but yet you don't speak that language, yet you don't go there, you haven't known it. You just kind of accept that you're this part, and all of a sudden you're mixed. And then all of a sudden all the mixed people come forward and say, well, what about us? I'm part this and part this, but you can't play all the parts. You have to be a human being first, and for us as a native person, that means human being. I'm totally down with you as a human being, and how we're treating Mother Earth. That's my individual plight, so to speak. I'm wanting to know how we can treat Mother Earth a little better than we have, you know. And I kind of alluded with Thomas King that the seeds are there, because we've lived here longer before 1492, and we know where we came from. And so now we're asking you to sort of step out of your skin and say, well, maybe these natives have something, you know, and maybe we got to be humbled a little bit, because after all, it's all going to hit the fan one of these days. So let's start reading about these peoples and watching documentaries and other media by native peoples that are made by native peoples. For everybody. And this book was written by Thomas King, who is Cherokee. And he's written this book, The Inconvenient Indian, because his experience is as a native person, as an Indian. The pledge line to call is 516-620-3602. For $100, this Inconvenient Indian is in house. They sent it last week. So we are sitting here with these books, 13 of them. I'm going to leave one of these books here because I lost my luggage. I lost my luggage when I was coming back, and this book was in that luggage, but it showed up. So I had the our producer, Liz Hill, sent them a request to get another one, and I got another one. So I'm sitting here with 12. Now I have 13, so I'm going to leave one of these books here, The Inconvenient Indian, A Curious Account of Native People in North America. So there's 13. So we want to give away these books. For all this time as a volunteer of, and there's people here that have been here since 1960, I think, or even before that. I'm not Bob Fast, I think, has here been here forever. That's a long time to be devoted to the truth. And that's the thing, truth, once you hear it, you can't steer yourself away. You cannot turn away from it. I mean, we try, but truth is in that conscience, but it's even better when it's your consciousness, because you always see it every place, and you want to know the history of a person, of an individual, and then you start understanding, okay, now we can do this. We have 8 left, folks, 8 of these books left, The Inconvenient Indian. We had 13, so that means there's 5 left. Oh, excuse me, 8 left. We have 5 given away, and we only have 27 minutes. So that's the time. You can jump on it right now by calling a number 516-620-3602, 516-620-3602, and offer your credit card or send in or even become a BAI buddy at this time during this slot from 9 to 11 this day, May 19th, Thursday, here on WBAI and First Voices Radio. Say, hey, I've been listening to Teoxin. It's the first time I've pledged, and now I want this book because I think this is that time. I'm ready for it. Maybe I wasn't ready before, but now I'm ready. And it's like we have to get off the addiction of America. Because has America been good? But has America been good for Native people? You think about that. You think about that. Even in the title, Ame, even in the title, Rica, Ame Rica. I know you Spanish speakers out there, or Latin speakers, even that, before Spanish, Latin. Spanish comes from Latin. So when you look at the etymology of Ame Rica, go do your research and find out what that means. And you'll find something similar to indigenous. Okay. All right, it's the irony of it. After all, we are still here, and it's a miracle. I'm paraphrasing Thomas King, that we're still here. We're supposed to be gone. Why didn't we kill all of you off? I'm not trying to make anybody feel bad about Native people. I'm trying to lift you up. Look, those peoples out there, you have helped us stay here. To stay alive, that thought about us. You became human before American. You were born human before American. You were born human before you voted. You were born human before you learned a language. You were born human before you read and were educated in a Western context. You were born human. So were we. And I think that's why those peoples who support Native peoples today are still human. Somewhere there. Regardless of their citizenship, you are born human like any other person in the world. You are born human, and I think that's part of the reason why WBAI, but also First Voices Radio, is still on the air. Because I still want to come and do these radio programs wherever I am. I still want to do that because I'm always asking questions about where do you come from? What does your name mean? Who are you? I don't want to know what you are. I want to know who are you? Where is your family from? These are the things I ask. Did you do something to your people that did you do something to your people that can't be forgiven? And why are you speaking now? If that's the way. So when you think about that statement, did you do something to your people? I'm going back to referring to, did you do something to Mother Earth? Because Mother Earth is always going to step forward and say, well, you know, we have these Indians who are always defending Mother Earth. So when you say, when I said, did you do something to other people, to your family, to your people? I'm talking about the human beings. I'm talking about desecrating Mother Earth and the Indians who are trying to bring the awareness. And I think we have. And I think that's why we are still here at WPAI, First Voices Radio. We have 80 of these books left. The Inconvenient Indian by Thomas King. The first hour, 9 to 10, we interviewed Thomas King. So you can go back into the archives and listen to that. Maybe now, but later, but try to, let's get rid of these books first here. 516-620-3602. 516-620-3602. It's summertime. It's springtime. It's summertime. Now it's the time to get this and take it to wherever you want to. This particular book in my hand has gone several places with me because I wanted to read it and reread it and reread it again. And that's what I have because I'm like, what does that mean? So I went and looked and found there's stories in it. There's facts in it. There's humor. There's tragedy. There's a resistance and the complexities of resistance and reinventing Native people, tackling tough issues like you here in New York do this. So why not include the Native people? Inconvenient Indian Inclusion. The Inconvenient Indian Inclusion. And as we were talking, Thomas King, you know, people ask me, how do you survive here in New York City? And I said, I look below the concrete. I look underneath the concrete. And I'm at home. I'm at home. Everybody else seems to be tourists going somewhere, coming from somewhere, but here. So that's what I can use. That's what I tell myself when I see someone who asks me, how do you survive in New York City? But I don't really tell them that. I just say, what makes me, helps me here is even anywhere I go, I look underneath the concrete. Because that says something to me. Mother Earth is speaking to me and saying, no, it's going to be okay. You just got to keep educating. You got to keep doing what you do because the message is not about you, Teokasin. The message is bigger than you. And I know that. 516-620-3602. 516-620-3602. $100, $100, The Inconvenient Indian, A Curious Account of Native People in North America by Thomas King, who is the author of this book. He is an award-winning novelist, a short story writer, script writer, a photographer. He's trying music, he said. And that's pretty cool. He's going to write a musical. His books include Medicine River, Truth in Bright Water, The Truth About Stories, One Good Story, That One, A Short History of Indians in Canada. And he is the author of several picture books by children, the editor of All My Relations, an anthology of contemporary Native fiction, and co-editing many other books. And he also was part of the CBC radio series, The Dead Dog Cafe Hour, quite the name. And he is a professor of English at the University of Guelph. Guelph, spelled G-U-E-L-P-H, Guelph, where he taught Native literature and creative writing. He, like he said, he's retired now and still has that humor. And he's been an activist. He's been a protester. He's been a campaigner. He's been an organizer. And he's been all these things that everybody else wanted him to be and he wanted to be or thought he wanted to be. Now he knows what he wants to be. And finding that experience as a Native person in North America. The book is a cover. If you go to the WBAI.org website, you can see it on the front, the cover of it. It's this giant steamliner. I would say it's a Titanic, and that's what I'd like to know. See it as the Titanic. And this Native person in a headdress on the shore looking over the waves, seeing the Titanic come. So this is, you know, what this is saying to me is like, where's this Titanic going? What did the Titanic do? This is the American, the Western way is to bring this big old touristy Titanic ship boat around and say it's unsinkable. But if you look at the political nature, the climate nature of what's going on now, and that Native person is still here. We are still here. I don't think anybody else. I don't think Native people. And a friend of mine, wow, he's another longtime friend, and I'm not trying to name drop. And he said, we grew up together. We went to school together. But he said this, that Native people, or he has a job. He, in particular, has a job that he cannot be fired from. But he's never been paid money for. He has a job that he cannot be fired from, but that he's never been paid money for. And that is a job as a Native person working for Mother Earth. That's a job that is full of responsibility. And it gives full right to Mother Earth to appreciate her, to nourish her, to take care of all life, not just the humans, not just the red man, the black man, the yellow man, or the white man. It's about the other life forms that we have among us. And that's what the job he has. And you now think about that. That's what Native peoples who are aware, if you look into the deeper corners of the newspaper, on the 10th, 12th, 13th, the last page, Native people are always in front, stopping the corporations around the world from destroying Mother Earth. Now, you are going to get it. Now, I was reading a piece the other day, Michael, about they have now reported that all continents in the world, there are the majority of indigenous, majority of any peoples standing up in resistance for Mother Earth are indigenous peoples. Across the continents, Native peoples are the majority of peoples standing up in defense of, against the destruction of Mother Earth. Now think about that. And we're only barely 1% of the whole population of the world. Now think about that. Man, think about that strength it takes for those peoples to stand up, to stop pipelines, to stop the pollution, the ongoing onslaught, the war against Earth. And the inconvenient Inn talks a little bit about that resistance and tells and shows you how they are doing it, these Native peoples in Canada, in the United States, around the world. So we are asking you, I'm asking you at 10:34 here on WPAI to pledge $100 to get this book. 516-620-3602. 516-620-3602. Call right now because we have a few minutes left.
We have a few minutes left, and we don't have a lot of books left. Tilkson, we're almost out of books. Ooh. We have three books left. So I'm telling you now, three books left. If you've been listening